Harris, and I'm interviewing Hank Morgan Wick at his home in Teaneck, New Jersey. Today's date is October 12, 1993. Hank, I wonder if you could tell me where and when you were born?
Yeah, I was born in New York City in 1929.
Okay, and you grew up there?
Well, I spent about 5 years there. After 5 years, I left New York and we moved to West New York. And,
West New York, New Jersey?
West New York, New Jersey, yeah.
Okay.
And I had two brothers and two sisters. And I went to school at St. Joe's Grammar School, St. Joe's High School in West New York.
I see, okay. Where and when did you start playing baseball?
I started playing when I was in grammar school, actually. It was all picked up teams. And, what happened was, I guess my parents went out, even though they didn't have any money, they went out and bought me full of catcher's equipment because I liked to catch. And I was the best uniform kid in the neighborhood. And I enjoyed catching so much that when I went to high school, I completed it. And I became a fairly good catcher. Couldn't hit that well, but I was a fairly good catcher.
Okay, how were your teams in high school?
So-so. St. Joe's didn't have real good sports teams because it was a very, very small school.
Okay, did you continue playing after high school?
I continued playing. I went to college. I went to Drake University and continued playing, but only on a like an intramural level in college.
I see. Where's Drake University?
That's out in Idaho.
Okay. When did you get started umpiring?
I got started umpiring when I was in high school. Actually, I had just finished, I had gone to Boys State. I don't know if you're familiar with Boys State. It was sponsored by the American Legion. I think that to this day they still have it. They have Boys State, Boys Country. And what they do is they pick one student from the junior class in each high school. And at that time we went to Rutgers University. And for a week, formed a state government, and we elected our own officials and everything. And when I got finished with that, I came home because usually I worked for the town of West New York in the Parks Department. And when I applied for the job, I came home and I applied for the job. They asked me if I'd like to umpire. Now I was 16 years old at the time, I thought they were kidding, but they were serious about it. And what happened was, I started to umpire. I went along with the joke, and I enjoyed it so much that I continued to do it. What happened was, I was working softball, and it was fellas who had just gotten home from the war, and these were all older guys, and I was 16, and I'm working with men. And needless to say, when I first started out, I got into more fights with the players. You know, I was a skinny little kid, and they were men. And I wouldn't back off. If I'd make a call, I'd stick with it. And we'd end up with actual fist fights on the field.
Men's softball. Right. These are men in their 30s, I assume?
Well, in their 20s and 30s. But they had just come home from the service.
Right.
They were, you know.
Right.
So what happened was, when I continued doing that through high school and college, and finally I decided I'd like to try it professionally. So I went to an umpiring school in Florida.
Which one?
I went to Bill McGowan's. That was the predecessor of, now it's the Joe Brinkman School.
Right.
Prior to that, it was the Umpire Development School. And prior to that, it was Bill McGowan's.
Was Mr. McGowan still alive at the time?
That was in 1954. He died in 55.
Okay, did you get to meet him?
I met him, yeah. In fact, I was signed to a contract the third day I was there. What happened in those days was the league presidents came around to see us work. And they didn't pick me because of my umpire. They picked me because of my hustle. What we did, we formed teams at the schools. And because there was nobody playing at that time, it was too early. It was in February and March. And we formed teams, and I was catching, and I hustled all around the field. So these presidents were watching everybody, played for about 7 or 8 innings, and finally they were going to pack it in, and they said, well, let's see the guy who's catching umpire. So what we did was umpire behind the plate a half an inning, umpire on the base another half an inning. And so what happened was I did that full inning of umpiring. That was the end of it. We finished. And before I left that afternoon, we went back to our rooms and we took showers and got dressed. And all of a sudden, they came into my room and said that one of the presidents would like to see me. And he ended up signing me a contract that was to the Georgia State League. That was a D League at that time.
So you had umpired in the softball league, gone
right
to the school, and then went right to the D League?
I went right to the D League, yeah.
Which,
yeah,
I guess now wouldn't happen. Is that right?
Not really.
You have to do a little work in the scholastic area?
Today it's more complex.
Oh, is that right? Okay. Can you tell me a little bit about Bill McGowan?
Yeah, Bill McGowan. Well, at that time, Bill McGowan was, I guess he was a senior umpire in the American League, and he was considered a real good umpire. His only problem was that he was a big gambler, and he liked to go to the track all the time, and things like that. And he was the president of the Piedmont League, which was a B-League. And when I finished my first year in B-Ball, Bill had called me up in the winter months. Bill called me up in the winter months and asked me if I would like to come to the Piedmont League that year. But what had happened, I had already been approached by the Carolina League, which was also a B-League. And I had signed a contract with Carolina.
So you were in a B-League?
I was in B-League the B-League. Second year. Yeah.
In your second year?
In my second year.
Okay. The B-League, the Carolina League, you called it, right?
Yes.
What kind of experience did you have there? What was the pay like? What was the travel like?
Okay, well, going back to the D-League, we started out with a $250 per month. $150 was salary, and $100 was gratuity.
Okay,
was expenses. Actually.
Okay, what year are we talking about?
That was 1954.
Okay, yeah. So then what about the Carolina League?
The Carolina League, they increased our salary to $300 a month. But what they did that year, they gave us a little extra expenses, so it wasn't too bad. Yeah. We were advancing, but what the trouble was, I got married just before I went away, and I couldn't really send any money home because I wasn't making any money to send home. So my wife was supporting herself.
What about after the Carolina League? How long were you there?
I was in the Carolina League for that year. And the following year, Bill Terry, who was the president of the Sally League, and A-League.
You mean the ball player, Bill Terry? From the Giants?
Yeah,
okay.
Giant, right. Hall of Famer, I guess.
Right.
He contacted me in the winter months and asked me if I'd like to come to his league, and I said, well, I certainly would. So what happened was he had an umpire-in-chief who lived in New Jersey, Sam Van Hook, and he asked me if I'd go and see Sam, and if Sam approved me, then he would take me in the league. So I went to see Sam. Sam lived in Clifton, and we got along very well, and Sam recommended me to Bill, and I spent the next 2 years in the Sally League.
Sally League is what level?
That was an A-League.
That's an A-League, okay.
Yeah.
What was that like?
That was a good league.
Yeah?
Yeah, I really enjoyed that league. And it really, we were starting to move up, and you could see the difference in the players. They were that much better at that point. And the experience was good, because we were improving our skills at that point. So,
as the level of play improves, you tend to improve too?
Oh yeah, definitely. If you didn't, you were in trouble.
Yeah, I bet. What was it like to umpire in those types of leagues? Did you have a crew that traveled
and
stayed together?
Yeah, basically all through the minor leagues until you got to AAA ball, it was two-man crews.
Two-man crews, okay, right. So you paired off and you stayed with one other umpire?
Stayed with one umpire.
You worked together all the time?
Yeah, what happened though, in the low minor leagues, the problem was umpires would start to umpire and they'd last maybe a couple of weeks and they changed like crazy.
The pay was so poor, it's not surprising.
The pay was poor, and some of the umpires were poor. And then a lot of them were school teachers, and they were filling in the summer months, too,
I see.
Things like that.
I see.
So they could do that in those years. Today you can't do that.
How did it work? Did you travel, if say your companion was like you and stayed into umpiring, would you travel with him to the different towns that he played in?
Yeah, basically, what we did was, the fellow who had the car, I had the car each year, so they gave me expenses for the car, so I became a crew chief. That's basically the way.
You got expenses reimbursed from the league?
I got expenses, I got so much to buy out.
Alright, so now, you're in the Piedmont League. How long were you in the
Sally League.
Okay, so how long were you in the Sally League?
I was in the Sally League for 2 years.
Okay, and what happened after that?
Okay, I guess in the middle of my second year, I was approached by somebody from the Washington organization. They wanted to sponsor me in the American League. And me being as naive as I was about it, thought that why should I be sponsored? I should be able to do it on my own. You know, I felt, well, you know, I've gone this far. I wanted to do it on my own rather than have one of the major league clubs sponsor me. I didn't realize that that was the situation at the time.
When you say sponsor, what did they actually?
They wanted to recommend me to the big leagues.
Why? Why would they come to you? Did they know you? Or?
Well, no, they liked my work.
They watched you?
Somebody
from the organization?
Yeah, well, see, one of the teams in the Sally League was a Washington.
Okay, so somebody there liked
you? Somebody liked me, and they had called one of the people in the Washington club
okay.
to watch me work.
Okay.
And as a result, they called me up to the office and wanted to sponsor me in the league. But again, like, I was naive, and I thought that that's not the way you do it. You did it on your own ability, you know.
So you refused?
So I refused. I said, I appreciate it very much, but I'd rather do it on my own. And they said, well, you're making a mistake, Hank, because that's the way it's done. I said, well, I said, I've gone this far, and I'd like to try to do it on my own. And naturally, I found out the following year that it was a mistake. I should have accepted it. But in the meantime, the International League was interested in me, and at the All-Star game, they bought my contract and one of the other umpires for the following season. That we would finish that season and then go up to the International
League. You went to the International League, which is a good league, right?
Which was a AAA league. It was
right.
a great league. You know?
Right.
At that time, that was a real good league.
Who were do you know any of the teams in the league at that time?
In the International League at that time, it was Montreal, Toronto, Buffalo, Rochester, Columbus, Richmond, Miami, and Havana.
Okay.
That was 1958.
58,
yeah.
Okay, so how long were you in the International League?
I spent 3 years in the International League.
Okay.
And my third year, I was supposed to work the Junior World Series, which was a series between the American Association and the International League, which
okay.
happened every year.
Right.
2 days before the season ended, I got word from one of the other umpires that he had heard I wasn't working on. That was Bill Williams, who was former National League umpire. Bill called me up and said that he had heard that somebody else was going to be working me and not me. So what happened was I called up the office. I wanted to find out what the story was. And they said, well, they had gotten orders from the American League to use Lou DeMuna and the National League to use Lee Wyatt. And this is, it's a political thing where they had certain guys that they were pushing were being pushed by somebody else.
Sponsored almost.
Sponsored, basically, yeah.
So
that's why, and I decided, well, if that's the way it's going to be, if it's not going to be on ability, then I might just as well get out because I didn't know anybody. I had passed up my chance with the Washington club when they wanted to sponsor me. So at the end of that season, I retired. Each year they kept calling me back to come back.
Who's going in the National League?
International League, yeah. And then finally it became the umpire development program, which the major leagues had sponsored. They put Barney Deary in charge of the umpire development program, that he would watch over the minor league umpires and develop them and bring them up the line until it came to the point where they would make the decision who was going to go to the big leagues. Well, Barney kept calling me each year, and each year I'd say, well, you know, don't waste your time, don't waste my time. If I'm a prospect, fine. I'll be willing to go back. So 1969 came around, and 68, I worked at College Roosters. When I came home, I started to work college baseball.
Okay, so after you left the International League, you started working college
games? I started
working
college, yeah.
Okay. Were you living in New Jersey at the time?
Yeah, I was living in, I believe I was, I had gotten married and I was living in Union City.
Okay, and so you did New Jersey college games?
I did New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, all around the area. And
what was the pay like with that?
With that, I believe at that time it was like, it started out at $17.50 a game. And when I finally stopped working, and I guess it was up to about $50 a game.
Okay. All right, so you said that they continued to call you, the International?
They continued to call me, and finally, in 69, Barney called me up, and it was near the end of the season. It was like in August. And Barney said, needed me, if I could come back, he could use me for 3 weeks. And I had vacation time coming up, and I figured, well, possibly. So I said to Barney, I said, what's the story? I said, it's the same thing every time you call me. I said, if I go back, I want to be considered a prospect. If I'm not a prospect, then there's no sense in me going back. So he said, okay, Hank. He says, we'll figure out a prospect. So I went back for the 3 weeks, and I finished the season out in the International League. And I was a little concerned because it had been 9 years since I had worked professional ball. And I figured, well, you know, going from college to professional, it might be a problem. Well, I got back there, and it wasn't any different than college ball at that point. Prior to that, it had been vast difference because AAA ball is like Major League ball is today. So when I went back, it was a breeze. I breezed through the 3 weeks, and that was it. I didn't hear too much more during the winter months until contract time came around. The International League sent me a contract, gave me a nice raise in salary, and I spoke to Barney, and I said, well, what's the story? He says, no, he says, they liked your work, and he said, we put down a prospect list, and we gave you a prospect. Well, that was, now it's 1970, that was my first year back after just that 3 weeks in 69. I went through the season, and at the end of the season, the umpires in the major leagues had a strike. And what happened was Barney called me up and asked me if I would work the National League playoffs. And, you know, I had knocked around the minor leagues, and I figured, well, it's not going to hurt me to work it because I worked with all the guys who were in the big leagues now. In fact, I was ahead of most of them, and I didn't get the shot. So I figured, well, it's my last hurrah. I'll work it. I don't care.
So you worked the National
League
playoffs
in 1970.
Which is what,
Cincinnati
and
Pittsburgh.
Okay.
Right. So what happened was they told us that we would receive the regular playoff pay that the umpires would receive. So myself and three other fellows agreed to work it. And all of us had been in the minor leagues for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we had nothing to lose at that point because we were getting up in age. And it didn't, you know, we figured, okay, we're going to give it a shot. So we went and we worked it. We had the first game, and Cincinnati ended up winning it 1-0. Or 3-0, I believe it was. They scored 3 runs in the 10th inning to win the ball game. And we didn't have a problem in the game. We had some good plays. We made some great calls. And the umpires, after that game, figured, well, okay, these guys can umpire, so we're not going to take a chance. They decided to go back to work.
This is after the first game?
After the first game. They decided to go back to work and continue their negotiations after the playoffs and before the series started. So they came in the second day. We were there the second day. We were all set to get dressed, and they said, okay, the other umpires are coming back, but we're going to pay you for the whole series. So what the salary was that year was $3,000. For the playoffs. So they sent us a check for $3,000. And so, you know, we stayed and watched the second game, and then we left. They paid all our expenses and everything was taken care of. So it was good. I went home, and the following day, I got a call from Barney, and he said that both leagues had approached him, and that if they didn't complete the negotiations in good faith, and the umpires didn't come back to work, that that they would like to have me with series.
This is the 70 series?
This is the 70 series, yeah.
Okay.
So what happened after the playoffs was over, I think Cincinnati put it pretty straight. And I don't know how the other playoff one was.
The American League with Baltimore and Minnesota.
Right. Okay. When they completed that, they finally negotiated before the series started, and they decided that they would go back to work and win the series also. Otherwise, I would have won the series that I did. Well, they were supposed to, the National League then was supposed to bring us the spring training. That was one of the things that they had said they would do for us working the playoffs for them. Well, what happened was they only did one guy a spring training, and that's John Grimsley. And I think it was only a gesture because they didn't even agree to give me a good shot in spring training.
So he didn't make it?
So he didn't make it. What happened was I was the only one from the National League crew who even got a shot. What happened was I went back and I worked the following season. I worked the 1971 season.
Where?
In the International League.
Okay.
Okay. And I worked the All-Star game that year, and I was in the Junior World Series, working the Junior World Series, when I got a call from Barney Deary saying that the American League was interested in me. Would I like to go to the American League? Certainly, you know. So but just to go back, a day prior to that, the umpire supervisor from the National League happened to be in the stands when I got there. He was looking at the umpires for the National League. And I walked up to him and I said, how you doing? He says, oh, hi, Hank. He says, I said, I haven't heard from you all year. I said, it was my understanding that you were going to give me a call and let me know what the situation was. He says, well, he said, we decided not to use you, he says, because you use the outside protector. And he said, all of our guys are inside now.
You worked the plate that one game in the playoffs? Really? Okay.
So what happened was... What happened was, he said, we decided against you because of that fact. I said, well, thank you very much for telling me. I said, I wish you had told me earlier. I said, but I'm glad you told me now. So I go out, and I was wearing the inside protector. I worked half the season with the outside protector, half the season with the inside protector. And he sees me working. I'm working quite hard to pick him up. I'm a super man. Well, the following morning is when Barney called me up and told me that the American League was interested in us. And I told him that I had spoken to the supervisor from the National League that night before. And he said, you know, it's funny, Hank, he said, because he called me up this morning also. And he said he was interested and he liked to sign me. And he said, but I had already made the deal with the American League. He said, so that was the way it went. He said, Charlie Berry is the supervisor for the American League. He'll be out to see you tomorrow. He'll be contacting you. So when he calls, you'll know what it is. So that night, Charlie called me and he said he'd like to meet me for breakfast the following morning. But when we met, we got talking a little bit. You know, he was more or less, he had seen me work, so he knew what I could do. Now he's just trying to find me out as a person. He wanted to see how I was and everything. And we got talking about different things. And finally, he says to me, he says, Hank, he said, how come you never tried out for the NFL? He says, well, I said, I really never gave it a thought. Apparently, Charlie had seen me working some college games. I was working Division I college football games.
Oh, that's fine, okay.
And to get in the NFL at that time, you had to put your name in, you had to submit your name and with your schedule, so that they could send scouts out there to do work. So what happened was, apparently, one of the guys that I was working with quite a bit was being scouted because he had put his name in, and Charlie Berry happened to be there three or four games after my work. So apparently he liked my work when I was working college football games. And I said, really never gave it a thought because baseball was my first love. He says, when you sure not? And I was glad to hear that, you know, because I thought I was a pretty good official, but that just affirmed what I thought. But anyway, getting back to the other, he says, okay, he says, I like what I see and everything. He said, I'm going to recommend it to you. And he said, you'll be going to spring training with us next spring. And that's what happened. When I went down to spring training the following spring.
Was it 72 now?
That was in 72.
Okay.
There were four of us going for one job.
Okay.
And what happened was, the one person who would have gotten it, because this guy was, had been picked by the umpire supervisor from the American League, he was going to get the job. But they're not going to come out and say that. What happened was, we go down to the meeting the first day of spring training, and he received a telegram while we were at the meeting from the umpire that he was going to put in, saying that he decided to retire, that he was going to work for his father. So now it left three openings for two umpires. Excuse me, two openings for three umpires.
Right.
Right. So three of us were going for the job.
Remember who you were going with?
Yeah, it was... actually, the guy who turned it down was A. Vance, was his name, and he retired. So now it was Jim Evans, Joe Brinkman, and myself. Well, what happened, the job that we were going for was O'Donnell's, Jake O'Donnell's. Jake was working in the American League and also in the NBA.
Right.
And what happened was, NBA had just given him a new contract of $25,000 a year. He was making $10,000 in the American League. So
he liked that.
He decided, and they guaranteed him for the next 6 years that he would get the playoffs for the next 6 years. So there was no way he could turn down.
Right. The money was good.
The money, yeah. So, and it was only working 87 or 88 games a year as compared to 162 games a year.
And you work every game.
You work every game.
Why?
So, as a result, three of us were going for the two jobs. And we got down to the end of spring training, and I had a great spring training. Billy Martin recommended me, and quite a few of the other managers had recommended me, because I hustled all the time, and I had good jobs. So what happened was, Jim Evans, about a week before it was over, Jim Evans was told that he had one of the jobs. Now Brinkman and I, and in fact Brinkman had been told that he didn't have the job. He was going back to the Long Hills. They left me in limbo.
They didn't tell you anything?
They didn't tell me anything. So finally, 2 days before spring training ended, Butler came up to me and told me that I had the job. I wasn't his choice because he didn't know me from Adam. He hadn't scouted me or anything. And
so how do you think he got the job?
I got the job because of Tosca, because of the managers had recommended me. So I started the following year, and I had a fairly good first year. You know, first year meant it is tough in the American League, you're the master league. Because the manager's going to test you.
Right. What was the pay back then? This is 72?
72, yeah.
What was the pay back?
First year salary was $10,000.
Okay. How did you travel around in those days? What was the difference? Travel-wise?
You
stayed with a crew, right?
We stayed with a crew, yeah.
Right.
We were signed four-man crew at the beginning of the season. And what happened was, we got a per diem plus our salary. The per diem was so much per day, and that was to cover our hotel expenses, the per diem covered our hotel expenses and other incidental expenses. We had an air travel card, we made our own arrangements for airlines.
So then that was charged to the league?
That was charged for it, yeah. Mm-hmm. And we flew first class, which was great, yeah.
And the hotel expenses, you stayed in good hotels?
We stayed in great hotels, mm-hmm. but at that time, we had great rates. They gave us very low rates. In fact, the early 70s, we were paying like $12 average per hotel, and that was single rooms.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Let me just ask you, the one game you worked in the 1970 playoffs of the National League,
Right.
Do you recall what you felt? Were you excited getting out there?
Well,
you did the plate, you said, so tell me about your pregame preparation and any Major League Umpire's pregame preparation.
Well, basically what we did was we just got together in the dressing room, and we had looked over the field prior to going in, so we knew basically what the ground rules were. They gave us a listing of what they used as ground rules, and so we basically knew exactly what to expect when we got out there. We went over that, and then we talked about our positions, how we would cover four man, because prior to that, most of our games were all three-man games.
Right.
So we had to just make sure that nobody, that two men weren't running out on a fly ball or something like that, or two men covering the same play on a base.
Right.
So basically that was our pre-game conference.
I've heard, and I think most fans have heard, that the balls were rubbed up by the umpires before the game with some mud.
Yes.
Did you do that game?
Yes. Well, basically what it is, Lena Blackburn, it sounds like a woman's name, but it was a man.
Right.
Pitcher in the big leagues. When he retired, he came up with the idea of using a certain type of dirt that was from the Delaware River.
Right.
It was a combination of mud and sand.
Right, they still use it today, if I'm not mistaken.
Still use it today. In fact, he died years ago, and somebody has continued it. And what they do is they sell like a pound coffee can and to each team. I think they buy three or four during the season now. And that's what we use to rub the balls up.
Okay.
Basically what they do is that you get five dozen balls prior to the game. You rub them all up with that mud. And it's the plate umpire's job to do that.
Right. So if I go to a store and buy a National League or an American League baseball,
right,
that's not what's actually used. I would have to rub it first, am I right?
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Take them out of the boxes?
You don't use a new ball, because if you've ever seen games where the pitcher will take the ball, if it's too slick, and it'll throw it right back to you.
Right.
So you got to rub them up.
Rub them up,
right.
Okay. So now, tell me the biggest difference that you noticed between the National League, I should say the American League, and the International League, the majors and minors. What's the biggest difference?
Basically,
the pay, of course, I'm sure.
The pay, definitely true.
Right, and the travel conditions, every lap was nice. Right. Tell me the difference in the level of play and how you treated.
Well, the level of play was considerably different, because you had the best in the big leagues. The pitchers were more precise. They threw it to the strike zone, you know. And the plays were that much sharper. The shortstop, the second baseman, they all played just that little bit better than Triple A ball. And in order to get there, they had to be that much sharper.
Yeah, that's true. Tell me about some of the things that happen on a major league level. Is it true, maybe, in some respects, that maybe some established veteran control pitchers will get close calls, and maybe some rookies who are known to be wild won't? Is that somewhat true, or is it a myth?
I don't think so. People would say that, but when you get out there, you're going to call a game the way you see it.
You're not affected by who's pitching at all?
You can't be affected, because if you are, then you're going to start giving the edge to somebody, and it's very noticeable. So you can't afford to do that. You're going to call your same game. The biggest thing especially when you're umpiring the plate, is consistency.
Right.
If you're going to start changing your style of umpiring or the height or the outside corners to every pitcher, just because he happens to be a seasoned veteran, it's going to be very noticeable. Mm-hmm. You have to establish a certain consistency. And when the players get to know that, if you happen to be a low ball umpire, they're going to know that you're going to call a low pitch. If you establish as a high ball umpire, they know you're going to call that pitch. So they want consistency. And if you're not consistent, that's when you see the arguments. That's when you see everybody complaining about pitches.
Were some of the catches in the American League talkative? Did you notice any trying to distract the batter and so on, and talk to you? And
constantly, yeah. There was some who did it. I'd say Thurman Munson was one of the biggest baiters of all.
He talked to the hitters.
Oh, he talked to the hitters, sure.
Did he talk to them nicely, or was he trying to
get
on them a little?
Basically, he was trying to distract them.
Well, how did
he'd be calling pitches, and he'd be talking to them about anything to distract them as the pitch was coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, some of the batters would step out and say, Hank, make them stop talking to me.
And would you have to?
Just say, shut up and leave him alone, you know.
Anybody else?
I think he was about the worst that I could recall. Yogi Berra was great. I didn't work too much behind Yogi. Years ago, I had worked behind him when I was in the minor leagues, but I worked some sprint training games.
Right.
He was great. He was high school.
Right. I heard that about him. How about some of the pitches that you saw? Can you give me a couple of names of some of the best that you saw in those days? I assume you worked
there. Well, I had seen a lot of them prior to even going to the big leagues. I had worked Bob Gibson quite a bit. He was in the minor leagues when I worked with him, some pitcher. He kept everything around him and worked fast.
Right. How about in the American League? I guess you saw maybe Jim Palmer.
I saw Jim Palmer.
Pat Michonne.
Yeah. I'd say Jim was a heck of a pitcher. He was a good pitcher. His big pitch was his fastball. He had a heavy fastball, and it worked like a sinker. All of a sudden, it just fell off the table, similar to what a spitball would do. Jim didn't throw a spitball.
Mm-hmm. How about some of the hitters? That you can recall, any of them that...
Well, I guess the biggest hitter who was there while I spent my time in the American League was Carew.
Right.
Who had gotten several batting titles, and,
right.
and Tony Oliva.
Right.
But Carew was an outstanding hitter.
Right.
He could make contact with the ball. That was a big thing. He was like Ted Williams. He saw the ball well, he made contact.
Right.
But I wouldn't take him on my team.
Tell me why, please.
Because if you ever noticed his stats, he was a leadoff hitter, and people say, well, he was a leadoff hitter, so he wouldn't get many RBIs. But he just never had the RBIs. You're a leadoff hitter to start the game, but you're not the leadoff hitter after the game starts.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to have some RBIs. He got his base hits, but he never seemed to get the base hits when people were on base or in scoring position.
Who did?
I guess there were quite a few of them in those days. On that particular team, Harmon Killebrew used to get them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cesar Tobar. He was a leadoff hitter, and he used to get a lot of RBIs.
Yeah.
Just with that club, you know.
You went by it also, I assume, in those days, in the early 70s, you're talking about the team, the Baltimore Orioles, for the prominent team in America.
Yes, they were. Yeah, they had the great pitching staff.
Right.
Yeah, they had Palmer, they had McNally, they had Cuellar.
Right. And Frank Robinson.
Frank Robinson was playing with them. Frank came a little after.
Came in 66, Frank Robinson.
Yeah, he was a little sooner. He had,
I think he left back. About 71.
Right, that's right. Brooks Robinson was playing.
Right.
Mark Belanger. Right. They had a good, great club. They really had a great club.
Can an umpire enjoy a game?
I think so.
Yeah?
Yeah. You can't... You can't be a fan. You can't root for any team. You have to be impartial. But you like to see certain teams win. You know, you have certain teams are good guys and certain teams are bad guys.
Okay.
So naturally, you like to see the good guys win.
If you thought you might have missed a call or maybe blown
right.
a call, manager comes out and argues.
Mm-hmm.
If in your mind you think you've blown it, how did you handle something like that?
Well, there were certain managers that you could handle it by saying, okay, I think I might have blown it.
You would say that at some
yeah,
to some of them?
Certain managers.
Right.
Certain managers. And they'd accept that. Okay, you're allowed to make a mistake. Their players are constantly making errors,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they'll accept the fact if you admit it to them. We didn't like to admit it too often, but like I said, there were certain managers that you could give it to. Other managers, you'd never admit to make a mistake because you'd end up chasing them, you know. And then it'd be all over the papers and everything else, so you couldn't do it.
I see.
Just like certain umpires, certain managers would come out and give an argument on play situations. And some of them were serious about it. Others would come out and say, look, Hank, I'm going to put a show on out here because I got to wake these guys up somehow. And you'd make the same arm gestures that they did and say, okay, it's fine, but don't make it too long. Just get out of here because I'm going to have to chase you. You know, and you put the show on just like they did. So a lot of it is acting. A lot of it is acting. Their play acting and your play acting.
Who were some of the managers, if you could tell me, if you didn't mind telling me, that you could say to them, I blew it, and they'd accept it?
Ralph Howe. Billy Martin, if you were one of the guys that Billy Martin liked.
He would accept the fact that you blew it?
Yeah.
Billy was managing, I assume, probably Texas.
He had Texas, he had, the first year I was there,
Detroit, yeah.
Then he went to Texas, then he went to... Minnesota, he had the year before that, then he ended up coming to the Yankees.
Mm. What kind of a guy was Billy? Did you get to know him at all?
Yeah, I get to know Billy pretty good. Billy was, he had a problem. You know, he had a drinking problem. And basically, that's what he did when he was open to it. That had nothing to do with what he did in the field. Billy was a great manager.
You believe he was a great manager?
He certainly was. His big problem was that when things were going bad, he'd keep it within himself. He didn't express himself, he just kept it inside. And he was like a time bomb waiting to explode. And when the situation happened, he just blew. If it happened to be me or somebody else he liked, that was the thing. Then he'd argue and get over real quick and he'd be up the field. But if it happened to be somebody he didn't like, then he'd start to kick the dirt and you'd end up having to chase him. So it was different. He had his likes and his dislikes.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have to do one of the guys you like, you're just supposed to.
And you were?
I got along great with him, yeah.
Okay, I guess I'll ask you a couple other guys. Earl Weaver?
Earl Weaver was a rules man. He was a baiter, really. He loved to bait everybody. I could tell you a few stories about Earl.
That's great.
Well, Earl, just one quick tip to get off that one, but Earl was a big smoker.
Right.
And he used to always hide in the corner of the dugout to smoke cigarettes. Well, I worked with John Rice my first year there. And John, every time Earl would come up to the plate for the pregame conference, they'd say hello, and John Rice would grab Earl's shirt and squeeze. He had his cigarettes in his shirt, so John knew him, and he'd crush his cigarettes before every game would start. And Earl would just go back and get another pack of cigarettes and he'd still hide in the corner of the dugout and smoke. You know, you're not supposed to smoke in the dugout, but he used to do it all the time.
Yeah.
Earl Weaver, I guess it was 1975, just a story about him. Mike Quayle was pitching. Mike was at the end of his career. Well, through the first four innings, he keeps complaining about pitches. And Russ Getz was behind the plate. I was at second base. And I'm thinking to myself, what's he complaining about? Russ is calling a good ball game. Whatever he's calling is what it's supposed to be. But Cuellar is, like I said, he's getting old, and he's getting to the end of his career, and he's begging for everything. Well, we get into the fifth inning. He's ahead 5-3. And as soon as the fifth inning starts, he starts again. And on one pitch, he charges the plate. Well, once he leaves the mound to question a pitch, then it's automatic. He's gone.
That's the rule.
That's an automatic expulsion.
So he can yell from the mound all he wants, but he can't
yell to a point. He can yell to
a point. Okay, but he can't approach you, walk the mound, and come walk towards the plate.
That's right.
Okay.
Okay, so what happens? He started to go towards the plate, Rush chased him. Well, I saw Earl in the dugout, and when Earl came out to argue, he'd always pull his cap down real tight. And when he got to Russ, his big thing is when he'd get in front of you, he'd stand in front of you, and then he'd start jumping up and down off the ground and beat the bill of his cap into your nose. Well, as soon as that happened, as soon as he made contact, Russ chased him out of the So now the game ends, Baltimore wins it. We go into the dugout, into the dressing room, and as soon as we get in there, there's a call. And Lou McPhail was the president of the league that year. Lee gets Russ on the phone, and he says, how come you chased Cuellar in the fifth inning when he had a chance to be the pitcher of the record? He said, well, what's that got to do with anything? He said, I didn't chase him. He said he chased himself. But what difference does it make what inning it was? He said, well, he could have been the pitcher of the record. He could have gotten a win. He said, the next time something like that happens, he says, I'm going to fine you, and he says, I'm going to suspend you. And he hung up on us. Now, I don't know if you realize the situation, but when Earl Weaver was hired as the manager of Baltimore, you know who the general manager was?
Must have been McPhail.
Lee McPhail. So they were pretty close. As soon as Earl got chased, he went into the dressing room and called Lee up. And he told his side of the story, and Russ never got a chance to tell his side of the story. But I figured, well, that's the way you're going to play the game? Right. The next night, I got first base. And I got a close play that goes against Baltimore. And I get a quarter of my eye, I see Earl pull his cap down and start charging me. So I figure, well, I'm going to nip this in the bud. As soon as Earl got to me, as he planted his feet on the ground, I put my foot over his. So as he started to jump, I just put some pressure. And we wore golf cleats. So Earl never got off the ground, and all I see is tears running down his face. And I said, Earl, what's the matter? And he said, Hank, you're on my foot. So I said, oh, I'm sorry, Earl, and I stepped off his foot. Well, needless to say, Earl walked off the field, limped off the field, never said a word. And that was the early part of the game. I never heard another word for the rest of the game. Well, about 2 weeks later, we go into New York, and Baltimore's playing. I had to play. And right from the first pitch, I hear somebody yapping from the dugout on every pitch that I call. And I caught Earl every time I'd look over, he'd duck into the corner of the dugout. So this went on for the first inning. And I just, you know, boy, I was listening, but I was ignoring it. Finally, the second inning starts, and the same thing's happening. So finally, I rip off my mask, and I go tearing over to the dugout. And as I get to the dugout, Earl steps up, and he turns his cap around, and he says, you're going to get me.
Okay, you were saying earlier he was a great newsman. He knew the rule book very well?
He knew the rule book. In fact, he carried it in his back pocket.
Right.
And he always wanted to come out and quote the rules if he did make a mistake on the rules.
Mm-hmm. And most of the calls are judgment, anyway.
Oh, yeah.
Very few rules things.
And
of course, of a game.
We had to know the rules pretty well because if we got caught on a misinterpretation, we'd lose our job right away. So.
I'm surprised you said that story about Lee McPhail. I think most fans think the umpires are backed very thoroughly by the league office and the commissioner. It always seemed that way, I would say.
In more recent years, it's been happening more so. But going back in those days, we never had that much fun. In fact, I'll go back to 72. I was working in Minneapolis. It was Detroit, was at Minnesota. And I was at second base. The game started, and we got through the first half inning. Now Minnesota comes to the plate. Cesar Tovar is the first hitter. And he tries to stretch a single into a double. And Dick McAuliffe was playing second base for the Tigers, and he made a beautiful tag on him to get him out at second base. Well, I got a little argument from him, and I got an argument from Bill Rigney, who was the manager at that time. And that was over. 2 plays later, Rod Carew does the exact same thing. He tries to stretch a single into a double, all over to the same place. Dick McAuliffe makes another great tag on him. I call him. And here comes McAuliffe. Here comes Bill Rigney charging me on the play, and I ended up chasing him. Now, this is a Monday night game of the week. It's being broadcast all over the country, national television. The president that year was Joe Cronin. Joe Cronin's back in Boston watching a game on TV. On TV, it shows that I made it 2 right calls.
The replays.
On the replay showed that I made it right for him. Rigney, when I chased him, this is the first thing that I chased him, because he goes over and the owner of Minnesota was sitting,
Calvin Griffith,
yeah. Was sitting in his box right next to the dugout. And he says something to Griffith, and all of a sudden I see Griffith on the phone. He's got a phone right in his box. After the game, I go into the dressing room, and it's Joe Cronin on the phone for me. Wanted to know how I could blow those 2 plays in the first inning and that one against the Packers, one against Minnesota. I said, I didn't blow them. And he said, well, he said, you blew them. He said, be a little more careful in the future. See, most people don't realize that Joe Cronin was married to Cal Griffith's sister, who was a nice person. One of them was married to the other one's sister, so it's family. And Joe Cronin is sitting back in Boston watching the game on TV. So what I'm trying to say is, you had to be careful who you call the plays against. Because if you called it against the wrong person, whether you're right or wrong, you were wrong.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's the way it was.
So how many, all right, let's get back to your career now. You did how many years in the American League?
I did 4 years.
4 years, okay. You never did anything else in the National League. You only did the one game,
just
right?
The one game, yeah.
All right, so I wouldn't really, would you be qualified to compare the 2 leagues?
Not really, no. Just what I had seen when I was in the league.
All right. What would it take, what did it usually take for somebody to get tossed from a game? Obviously contact. How far would you let somebody go?
Well,
did it vary, or, I mean, did you have a...
Well, every umpire is different.
Right,
you have your low points, you have what you're going to take. For me, I was pretty good. I let them have their say. The thing that would get them chased would be profanity directed at me. If they were to come up and say, well, I'll be a dirty, they're not directing it at me, but if they say, why are you dirty? That's directed at me, so then I'd run. So, there were certain things that was automatic. If they did certain things, they would be run automatically. So, you know, it was pretty much what your temperament was, what you could take from a woman.
You did 4 years in the American League. What happened? Can you continue?
Well, what happened in the fourth year, my first year was a little rocky because it was the first year. Second year went great. My third year went great. My fourth year was super. What happened in my fourth year, a couple of the umpires were having problems with all the clubs. Every time you picked up a paper, you saw one of their names in the paper. There were two, specifically was Art France and Jeremy Becker, were constantly in trouble. And the owners were screaming for some changes. They wanted umpire changes.
This is what, 75?
This was in 75.
Okay.
And both of them had tenure. So when you got tenure, it was a little more difficult to get rid of them. So in order to appease the owners and the managers, they had to make some changes.
You mean they just had to get rid of some
umpires? They had to get rid of somebody. They had to make some changes. So they got rid of Rodriguez, who was a Spanish-speaking umpire. He couldn't speak enough. Good umpire, but he just couldn't speak enough. He'd speak English. And myself, who didn't have tenure, I was the most recent guy. They weren't going to touch Jim Evans because Jim Evans was the favorite of the umpire supervisor. He was his boy, so that they'd never touch him at all. So I was the logical person. So they got rid of me. In fact, when they called me into the office to tell me that they weren't going to renew my contract, I asked them why. He said, "Well, this is Dick Butler now. We've had some bad reports on them." I said, "Is that right?" I said, "Could I see them?" He said, "Oh," he said, "we can't do that. That's personal stuff." I said, "If it's personal, it's about me." I said, "Then I should be able to see them." He says, "Well," he said, "I can't show up to you." I says, "Well," I said, "probably because you don't have any reports on them." He said, "You might be right, thank you." I said, "If I had such a bad year," I said, "how come I didn't chase anybody over here? That's kind of a year I had." In fact, the last month of the season, my crew chief and one of the other guys, Marty Springstead and Don Denkin, would, every time we'd go up to the plate for the lineup changes, they'd say to the managers, "Do something to make them chase it today," because they had been chasing guys all year. And they couldn't see me going through the season without chasing something. So that's the whole last month of the season went through like that. And I didn't have to chase anybody. It was that kind of a season. So I said, "How come, if I'm that bad an umpire, how come I didn't have to chase anybody? I got along with everybody the whole season. Never had the problems that you're talking about." He says, "Well," he says, "apparently they were afraid of you. They were afraid to argue with you." I said, "Don't give me that baloney." I said, "They're not afraid of anybody." I said, "If they're going to argue with you over a play, they're going to argue with you." I said, "So don't give me that. That's a lot of garbage." So he as much as admitted, without coming out and saying it, that it wasn't because of my work. It was because they had to make some changes.
You mean just bring out, just take out some guys who were not tenure and bring in some new guys?
Yeah.
Because they had to replace you.
They had to replace
you. Did they think that the new guys would do a better job than
you? Well, Butler had, he had been scouting other umpires. So he had favorites, and he was going to bring those guys.
Is that so? That's what it was. So there was some favorites.
Sure.
How many guys had to get let go besides yourself?
Two of us, just two of us.
Just you and somebody else?
Yeah, right.
Boy, that must have been a bit of Billy Swan.
Oh, it was. It was. In fact, I had, I'm trying to think of the fellow from Cleveland. He was an attorney in Cleveland. His grandfather was a great Cleveland ball player. I'm pretty sure he was a Hall of Famer. And I had
April?
Going back years and years ago, it was back in the early 1900s, and he wanted to defend me if there was a lawsuit, but in order to defend me, in fact, there was another group of umpires wanted to defend me also, and in order to defend me, the American League had to make a statement. The American League refused to make a statement. They said that as long as we don't say anything, nothing can happen, and they were aware of the whole thing. So they would never make a statement. In fact, they never put it in the papers that I was released, or they weren't renewing my contract or anything. And usually when they didn't renew a contract, they put it in the in that certain part of the papers where they talk about the transactions. Yeah, okay. There was never anything in there. So it was just one of those situations. Okay. And it was, like you said, it was a bit of pill to swallow because I love baseball.
Wow, that's really something.
Yeah.
Has that kind of thing happened since?
I don't know if it has. You know, I've lost contact. I really don't keep up with baseball that much anymore.
I'm not aware of this happening after this happening. How long did it take to get tenure?
6 years.
6 years, so you only had four?
I only had four, yeah. As a result, though, they ended up giving me my pension.
Oh, so you got a pension
now?
So anyway.
I got a pension. Not much of a pension, but a small one.
What did you do then after that?
Well, I went back to college umpiring. I umpired for 1 year, and then I had a heart attack. And when I had the heart attack, I decided, well, there's no sense going back umpiring again. I don't want to take any chances. And what happened was the ECAC, the Eastern Collegiate Athletic Conference, had asked me if I'd like to be an assistant commissioner and do all the assigning of the baseball games in the East, which I accepted, and I did it for about 3 years.
And then that was over?
That was over, yeah.
So
while I was doing it, though, the situation came up again where the umpires went on strike in the major leagues. And four of my umpires, all of a sudden, I don't know if they made the call, or if they, I imagine they initiated the call, that they would offer their services to work the big league games. And what they did is they went and worked without my knowledge. And after I found out about it, we had a rule in the ECAC that if you were to work a professional game, you were no longer eligible to work college games for the rest of that
year. So they
did
a minor league game?
So, no, they did the major league game.
They did a major league game?
Yeah, when the umpires went on strike.
Oh, okay.
Filled it in New York.
I see.
Okay. So now I called each umpire up after I saw that they had worked that first game. And I gave him the option. I said, look, I said, these are the rules. I said, if you want to continue to work, that's up to yourselves. It was a Friday, I guess, that it opened up. And they worked the first game on Friday. I said, I'll give you the option to work the rest of the weekend. And I said, when the weekend is over, I said, if you continue to work after that, then I won't be able to use you for the rest of the season. So you make the decision. Well, by Sunday, they all called me back and said that they had done what they wanted to do. They had worked a major league game, and they were willing to give it back to them.
Hmm.
Well, what happened then? They didn't have any umpires to
major
work, to work the major league games. So they immediately called me up, being in charge of baseball with the ECAC, and they asked me to supply them some umpires. I said, I'm sorry. I said, I can't do that. I said, because any umpires that I would assign you, I said, would no longer be eligible to work college baseball. And they tried to give me an argument. I said, look, I said, that's it.
Who called you?
It was Bruce. Not him directly, but
his office.
From his office. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was the commissioner's office.
Right.
Department.
So they couldn't work any
so
game,
I,
so that was the
so
end
that
of
that.
So
that was the end. So okay. They had to go out and get their own umpires. And there were other guys who were willing to work, so it wasn't too bad.
Okay, so then you did the ECAC for a little while. Did you do anything else after that?
Not really. I've done college baseball, football, and basketball. I was division in baseball and football also. And,
so you did basketball too?
So I did basketball too, yeah. And I just went from season to season.
Wow.
And I had hectic schedules, but what I enjoyed doing, I enjoyed it this year.
Okay, what kind of work did you get into then?
Well, I had been working with a company, paper company, mm-hmm. for years while I was in baseball. Mm-hmm. And I went back to work with them. I went back to work with them full time after that. And I stayed with them for 7 years. And then they went out of business and I formed my own company.
I see. Okay. Just, I guess, one or two more. You said you don't follow the game at all now, right?
Not too much, no. Yeah. Every once in a while. For a couple of years, I had a lot of business I did business forms. I manufactured business forms. And I had a lot of accounts down around the Washington Ballpark. So I used to get down there quite a bit and go to see some games. Basically, to go and say hello to the umpires. I'd stay for a minute or so and then I'd leave.
Were you a fan of anybody growing up, any team?
Brooklyn Dodgers.
Brooklyn Dodgers.
Yeah. In fact, it was funny because I had a tryout with them. I just couldn't hit, so that was the end of that.
I see.
But when I first started to umpire, I guess for 6 years straight, I went to spring training with the Dodgers.
That's interesting.
I saw the great ball players from the Dodgers.
From
when they were in Brooklyn, mm-hmm. and when they went to L.A.
When they first went out.
Yeah.
So you saw the boys of summer, so to speak.
Oh, I saw some great ones.
Really? Well, that must have been interesting and exciting. Okay. I don't believe I have anything else to ask. I've enjoyed it tremendously. If you have another story or two, I'd like to hear it. Otherwise, I think we're done.
Well, I could add a few little stories.
Go ahead.
No hitters. I umpired Nolan Ryan's fourth no hitter behind the plate, which tied him with Sandy Koufax.
Right. How was it to umpire a game he pitched?
Well, I had his first game in the American League mm-hmm. when he pitched with California against Texas, and he didn't last two innings.
Yeah,
he just couldn't find the plate. Mm-hmm. I saw him about 3 weeks later in California, and he was a completely different pitcher. Mm-hmm. They had a pitching coach in California. I can't think of his name. Jimmy's, I can't remember his name, mm-hmm. but he's in his 80s now, mm-hmm. and he's still pitching coach.
Oh, Jimmy,
in California.
Jimmy Reese, maybe?
That's it, Jimmy Reese.
Right.
And Jimmy found something that Nolan was doing wrong. Mm-hmm. And apparently he corrected it, and from that point on, Nolan Ryan couldn't be beat. You know, he got his 10 strikeouts a game. He was tremendous.
Anybody throw harder than him you've ever seen?
Well, going back a few years, Juan Pizarro.
Really?
Yeah.
He threw harder than Nolan Ryan?
He threw harder than Nolan.
Really? The lefty with the White Sox.
Yeah. Then who was it? Well, I had Bob Gibson who threw hard. Mm-hmm. Who's the voice of the Cleveland Indians now? Got hurt by...
Herb Score.
Herb Score, he threw hard.
Yeah.
I worked him several times mm-hmm. when I was in the minor leagues. Mm-hmm. Basically, that's it. Yeah. In fact, Nolan Ryan, when he threw a split no hitter, he threw, I'd say, probably about 70% curveballs. He set him up with his fastball, and then he threw most of the curveballs. And he threw in the same motion, so mm-hmm. you couldn't tell.
Yeah,
he
had a big breaking.
But his curveball was a strike.
Yeah.
He threw strikes with his curveball. Yeah.
Personal, I wonder if I could just ask you about the late Thurman Munson, what your opinion of him was as a ball player, as a person.
Thurman was a hell of a ball player. He could be a little, he could be a pain in the neck at times. He was a situation catcher. You could be calling pitches all the game long, same way, and all of a sudden in the last couple of innings, if he needed a pitch, like he'd look for a low one. And right away he'd jump up and get in your face and start arguing about the pitch and he'd straighten him out real quick.
Mm-hmm.
He'd get down and start catching again. The next inning he'd come up to the plate and he'd call that same pitch that he wanted. And he'd turn around and start to say something and don't say a word, Thurman, that's the same pitch you wanted last inning. and he got the message real quick. Mm-hmm. But he was a situation catcher. He looked for certain situations.
Very competitive, I guess.
Very competitive, yeah. He would have probably been in the whole thing.
Yeah, he was a great hitter.
He was a bad ball hitter, just like Yogi Berra.
Right.
He'd take him off the ground, right off the shoe box.
Right. What about Ralph Houck? I wanted to see if you could tell me a little bit about Ralph.
Ralph was the old type manager. He'd sit there and he'd let the guys play ball. He didn't look for he wasn't a nitpicker. He didn't look for little things to get on the players or get on the umpires. As long as they were doing their job, leave them alone. Then every once in a while, he'd go bananas, you know, and he'd put on the show. Mm-hmm. And that's where some of these, like Billy Martin and Earl Weaver got their antics mm-hmm. from. They got them from
Ralph Houck.
From Ralph Houck, sure.
Yeah. What about
throwing a cap and then kicking it there, you know.
Did you do a game with Sparky Anderson at Detroit? Was he at Detroit then?
He was in,
was it Cincinnati when he did the playoff game?
I had the playoff in Cincinnati.
And was he in Detroit by the time he was still working?
I don't think he was. I think Ralph was still there. Yeah, that was his last. In fact, I think that might have been his last year. I think Sparky came the following year.
I see.
Yeah.
How did Sparky treat you in the one game you did?
Oh, great. I had Sparky in the minor league, so I had known him before that. Uh-huh. So he remembered me, so we got along fine. No, Sparky was all right. He wasn't a big league ball player per se.
Right.
He had a cup of coffee up there.
Right.
But he was a great competitor, and he manages well. He gets a lot out of his ball players. He doesn't seem fiery. He sits there and he sits back. He's like a rock out ball player.
Mm-hmm.
He knows what he expects of the ball player, what they're supposed to do, and as long as they're doing it, that's all he wants. They can't do any better than the
player's manager. That's a way I was right about
that. Sure. Yeah,
anybody else that you could? Who was the best manager then? I guess in your opinion. That you've seen, just from your time on the field those few years. You mentioned Billy Martin, you said he was a great manager.
Earl was a great manager.
Yeah.
Just a pen in the net.
Right, but he knew how to manage.
Well, you could see that from the years that he had
You said Bill Rigney, you knew him?
Bill Rigney was a so-so manager. Alvin Bach had for a couple of years. He was all right.
How about Dick Williams? Did you get the name?
Dick Williams was a good manager, but he was situation manager.
Mm-hmm.
He was brought up under Ricky with the Dodgers. And Ricky's attitude years ago was get on the umpires. Get on the umpires. And sooner or later the umpires are going to give you something. So that's the way he operated. He constantly get on the umpires to see if he was going to find it.
This is Dick Williams.
In fact, I had one situation with Dick, with Dave Orr pitching. And I look at this football. The first time Gaylord pitched in the American League.
You're talking about Gaylord Perry?
Gaylord Perry.
Yeah.
First game he pitched in the American
Cleveland,
League.
Cleveland, yes.
He was with Cleveland.
Yeah.
He was pitching in Texas. Yeah, when Gaylord first came to the American League, they were going to stop, nip it in the bud. They were going to stop. And I was working the plate in Texas, the first game he was pitching in the American League. And I got a call from Joe Cronin, who was the president that year. That was in 1972. And Joe said, any pitch that looks suspicious, take out of the game, put a mark on it, put it in a separate bag, and send it to our office. We're going to have it go to a lab. We're going to check him out and stop it right away. Well, by the third inning, I had about two dozen baseballs that were suspicious, and I put them in a separate bag. I marked them, gave them to the ball boy. He put them in a special bag.
Did Perry know you were doing this?
No. At the end of the game, I sealed the bag up. We had a lock for the bag and a key, the same key opened every day. Send it to the league office, and they were supposed to send it to the lab to have it checked. And apparently they did, but they never did anything about it.
Could you tell he was throwing something?
Well,
something
you knew something was out of it because what I was seeing was like a half moon shape mark on the baseball.
It was cut
like,
in a little bit?
No, it was dirt. So apparently he had something under his hands. And he was giving like a brownish half moon shape.
Is he rubbing some dirt on from under his nail?
Well, basically, I found out later what it was. It was odorless, colorless, vaginal gel.
I see.
Okay. But he would put it under his nails, and that's how he'd load it.
So he'd do it each inning, I guess.
He'd load it up each inning. Okay. So what happened was, I sent all the balls to the league, nothing ever happened. The following year, I had Dick Williams. They're playing in Cleveland, and Mike Epstein is at the plate. And first pitch comes at the mic, and he swings at it. It was loaded, you know, but nobody was calling it because we weren't getting back on it anyway, so there was no such call. So Mike said, turns to me, he says, Hank, he said he's loading up. Next pitch comes in, the same thing. Finally, the third pitch comes in. And Gabriel is probably enjoying himself out of the mound, you know, because he's getting away with it. And Mike, finally, he just swings at the third pitch that comes in, and he starts to charge the mound. Half hearted charge. He's walking out with the bat in his hand, you know, he's going to get Gabriel. So I jumped in front of him. I said, Mike, I said, what are you doing? He says, he can't do that to me, Hank. I said, what do you mean? He can't do what to you? He said, you know he's loading him up. He can't do that to me. I says, Mike, I said, stay. I says, come on. You know he's not doing anything. I said, come on, let's get off the field now. Here comes Dick Williams. Dick says, what are you going to do about it? I said, what am I going to do about what, Dick? He says, he's loading him up. He says, what are you going to do about it? I said, I'll tell you what. I said, I'll go out and check him out. And I said, how's that? He says, okay. I start to walk towards the mound. Dick starts to follow him. I said, wait a second. I said, I'll check him out, not you. I said, you stay right there. So I go up to the mound. I said, Gaylord. I said, I don't know if you're going to believe this or not. I said, they think you're loading the ball up. And Gaylord sheepishly looks at me. He says, no good. He says, you're not serious. He says, no. I said, I have to check you out, Gaylord. I said, let me see your glove. I take his glove, and his glove is bone dry, and he's got a big hole in the middle. He's got no glove to use. I had about him. I said, let me see your cap. And his cap is soaking wet.
Sweat?
From sweat. So I feel around his belt. You know, I got to go through the potions. I said, Gaylord, I said, we're going to really do it. There's nobody in there. There's probably 2,000 people in the stands in Cleveland. I says, take your sugar.
Right on the mound?
Yeah. He says, you're not serious, Hank. I said, yeah, I'm serious. I said, he wants me to check you out? I said, I'm going to check you out. So he takes his shirt off. And he goes to hand it to me. I said, get out of here. I said, soaking wet. I said, what do you want me to do? And I'm keeping my back to Dick because I don't want to see him. I don't want him to see me smile at my break, you know. So I said, put it back on. Okay. He puts it back on. I said, okay. I said, you want to go? He says, yeah. He says, well, let's go. I start to walk directly back towards the mound, and Dick is standing between third and the plate. I mean, directly back towards the plate. He's standing between third and the plate. And I'm ignoring him. I'm going right back to the plate. Finally, he says, well? He's got his hands on his head. He says, well? So I turn to him. I says, well, what? He says, what are you going to do about it? I said, I already did it, Dick. I said, you asked me to check him out? I said, I checked him out. And I started to walk back towards the plate again, and he started to come after me. I said, whoa, I said, wait a second. I said, I did exactly what you asked me to do. I said, now, if you take another step towards me, I said, I'm going to chase you. And he knew I meant business because I just wasn't going to take this nonsense. I had had dealings with him before, and you know, he was cruel. He really was. I said, that's it. And he was, you know, ready to come after me, but he knew better because he knew he was going to end up getting chased. So he turned around and walked back towards the dugout.
He was with Oakland.
Yeah, he was great manager.
Yeah.
Great manager. But like I said, he was from the rookie era, and they tried to give him a reasonable finish. But he had a great club. He had a great club. Which also made him a great manager.
Well, that usually does.
Yeah.
Trying to think of anybody else from that era. Chuck Tanner was around at that
Chuck
time.
Chuck was there, yeah. In fact, he had the club with Wilbur Wood.
Whitehead.
He had Bruce Gossage,
mm-hmm.
Terry Forster.
Right.
Bruce Gossage was a so-so reliever in those years.
Right.
Terry Forster was the big fireman. He could really throw them.
Right.
And it turned out that Terry was gone the next couple of years, and Gossage became a great pitcher.
Yeah. How was Tanner as a manager?
Tanner was good. He was a fair manager. I think that he wanted everything he could get, but he didn't try to show anybody up on that point.
Mm-hmm.
He did his job. He went out and did his job.
Any other names you can remember that I haven't thought of? I'm trying to think of the teams, and
yeah.
I can't come up with all the names. But
let's see, who was managing for us then? That was the third baseman.
Well, you've done plenty as it were. Okay, I'm gonna shut the tape off. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.